Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Election 2020, the impact on housing finance. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy at Amherst Pierpont. I'd like to remind everyone that this call is closed to the press. If you are a member of the press, please disconnect now. Thank you. This is the second of three calls on Election 2020 and its implications for the capital markets. Today, we turn to the markets in housing finance, which are almost certainly the most politicized corner of U.S. fixed income. Government involvement in mortgage finance goes back to the 1930s with the founding of the Federal Home Loan Banks, the Federal Housing Administration, and the original incarnation of Fannie Mae. And politics and housing finance have only become more tightly intertwined since. There is a lot at stake. The U.S. now has a residential housing market worth more than $33 trillion. We finance that with more than $11 trillion of single-family mortgage debt and another nearly $2 trillion of multifamily. And more than half of that financing comes from the capital markets. Housing also has become a bigger part of the discussion about equality. And right in the middle of this sits policy choices that could differ in important ways across a Republican or Democratic administration. I'm joined today by Bob Ryan, who has been instrumental in shaping housing finance in more than three decades in and around Washington, D.C. He left his most recent policy job in the summer of 2019 after more than 5 years at the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the regulator for Fannie, Freddie, and the Federal Home Loan Banks. There he served as acting deputy director of the Division of Conservatorship under Director Mel Watt, a Democrat, and special advisor to current director Mark Calabria, a Republican. Before that, he served as senior vice president at Wells Fargo Home Mortgage and in senior roles at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, including as the very first chief risk officer of FHA. Bob, thanks for coming on the call today.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So, Bob, I'd like to take about 20 or 30 minutes to ask you about a couple of different topics, and then we'll throw the call open to questions from the audience. For the audience, we don't have slides today, and I'd like to remind you as well that we have a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen, and you can use that chat feature to ask questions at any time during the call. But we will draw from those questions during the audience Q&A. So I guess the place to start, Bob, is probably with the current administration and the current FHFA policy, at least to start focusing on Fannie and Freddie. And presumably that draws a roadmap for what we would see in a Republican win. It seems that Mark Calabria wants to recapitalize and release Fannie and Freddie into the private markets. And I was thinking maybe you could just tick off the steps involved in finally putting them back out into the market.
Sure, Steve. There are three really high-level steps, I think, that are critical. There are many more details, but the high-level ones are, first order is really to finalize the capital rule, and so that's well on its path going forward, and so we should expect something on that. Second one is then to amend the preferred stock purchase agreements, or also the senior preferred stock purchase agreements, or PSPAs for short. And here, the most significant issue is resolving the government's ownership interests in the GSEs. However, they may choose, FHFA, that is, in the administration, may choose to also try to lock in some of the policy decisions that they've made while in conservatorship, and so they could tinker around with that. That could be ways of shrinking the footprint, potentially further reducing the investment portfolio limits, and then some of the things that they've locked in. You'd like to lock in some conservatorship policies, such as potentially guarantee fee, LLPA type of pricing, servicing standards, potentially multifamily caps. Those would be some of the types of things that they could consider in that second thought.
Well, let me ask you about the capital rule then. And I guess we could go into the details of the capital rule, but what's the broad intent of the version that Calabria, has in place right now? What is he trying to accomplish?
Well, I think there's a view with FHFA and the administration that the GSE's footprint is larger than it needs to be, and that they have a capital advantage over banks. And so I think a big piece of their intent is to level the playing field here with banks, try to take some of that advantage away and then therefore maybe reduce the footprint of the GSEs. However, I'd note that the GSEs aren't banks, and they have different and generally less risk than banks. While they are still monolines, their loss experience reflects kind of that specific piece. But the risks are they have no funding risk or interest rate risk to speak of for MBS loans sold. They have been transferring the vast majority of all new acquisition risks that they've been acquiring. And so they are in a different spot. So leveling the playing field is certainly a reasonable approach, and I concur with that. But it should be based more on the same type of capital requirement for the same types of risk. And I don't think that's really what's happening here by using the Basel framework for banks.
I know that you and some of your colleagues have written a bit about the capital rule, and there's a few points where you find weak spots in the current proposed FHFA approach. I mean, are there one or two or several that are worth highlighting there?
Well, I think one in particular, the first one is the overall level of the capital rule is much higher than we expected. And again, higher, we can certainly quibble at the margins about what the right capital is. We're capitalizing them generally to a 2008 type of stress environment. But that certainly has a potential impact of much higher guarantee fees going out, and so kind of undermining and potentially shifting business away from the GSEs in that footprint. So that's certainly part. Another surprising one is the approach on CRT. And here there were a number of adjustments to the capital rule that reduced the amount of capital relief the GSEs would get for using capital, CRT, credit risk transfer transactions. And that just seemed odd, given that it was actually, it's providing more competition with private investors investing in these companies, diversifying kind of the sources of capital for it. And so that seemed to strike us as kind of a reversal of that. And then even and beyond that is if they were to make some tweaks to the amount of capital relief, I think there was a large amount of feedback on that. They still then have a very high leverage ratio at 4%. And it was kind of our view and assessment that if you wanted credit transfer to be anywhere near the amount of credit risk transfer that the GSEs have been doing, you'd probably need a leverage ratio that's much closer to 2 or 2.5% for that to still be economic. And finally, in this basis, was part of that elevation of the capital is based on a bunch of or several risk invariant buffers, and there's not a lot of understanding of kind of where the basis is, what the basis is for those, but those also obviously have some implications on the ability to do a credit risk transfer because you can't relieve that because it's not part of actual loss results.
Interesting. So there's certainly a couple of major changes to the GSEs if that capital plan goes in place. Let me ask you. You mentioned the PSPA, and I'm not sure if everybody has that on the tip of their tongue. Could you kind of remind everyone what that is and why it's important?
Sure. PSPAs are a contractual agreement between the government and the GSEs, and obviously FHFA while the GSEs are in conservatorship. But it really is really the terms and conditions of the government providing the net worth backstop for the GSEs. So it's a critical component of that. And in order, a consideration as we kind of think about the PSPAs and what has to be changed, is this is where you would try to have to think through how those ownership interests are going to change to get the GSEs out of conservatorship. And they'd have to be reduced dramatically to reduce the taxpayer's stake, government stake, and then pretty dramatically. So, for example, today taxpayers have about $220 billion of senior preferred position, which carries a dividend, the net worth sweep, equal to the entirety of their GSE profits at the moment. And on top of that, they own warrants in about 79.9% of the GSE's common equity. Just that combination of things obviously renders the GSEs completely unviable. So something has to change pretty dramatically. How this will impact taxpayers is a large and challenging consideration as they think about moving them out of conservatorship. And it's also fraught with, many political and legal challenges as well. So it's a big chunk, but an absolute necessary chunk of what has to be resolved.
So I guess I would imagine that if the taxpayer has borne the risk essentially on the GSEs since 2008, and has that large an ownership stake, that the taxpayer would want some compensation for giving up that kind of large position. I mean, how do you figure out that process, and how do you figure out what fair value would be?
Well, this is where Treasury, in particular, is on the hook to try to work through those. But clearly, while it's not contractually the case, I mean, there has been a number of dividends that have been paid back to the government for extending and covering the losses under the PSPA. Some have suggested that those have exceeded the 10% original coupon on the line. Others have suggested that's not legitimate, that's not legally actually how it kind of necessarily works. So this is actually why it's quite difficult. They have some ability to convert the warrants and then retain some equity or sell the equity at a later time. So this is all part of what has to be resolved, and it's really a combination of Treasury and to some extent the Department of Justice as they kind of think through the contractual agreements here and the government's obligations.
Okay, so that sounds like it would be a pretty significant lift. You talked a little bit about what might be involved in, or at least some of the issues that are in the capital plan, and you noted that one of the first steps in recapping and releasing the GSEs would be to finalize those capital plans. So what's the process from here? What would Calabria have to do to get that done?
Well, I think they've, as far as just the capital rule itself, they have obviously put the rule out for comment. They've closed that comment period. They are, I'm sure, reviewing and assessing the feedback that was provided, and then they will make changes to the rule as appropriate, and as they see appropriate based on the feedback, and issue a final rule. And I think that's very, very likely to happen before the end of the year, certainly doable. There's always an outside chance that something that some of the feedback was so significant, a departure, and that they want to accept is so significantly a departure that it would require a reproposal of the rule. But kind of my sense is that that's not likely. They've pretty dug into this approach, and so I don't anticipate that necessarily slowing it up. So they'll have to go through that. They'll have to put capital restoration plans in place, or work with the actually go through a deliberative process of asking the GSEs to produce those capital plans. So that kind of, how much capital do they have to raise? That begs a little bit of the question of, as we talk about some of the possible changes to the GSE's footprint and how the capital rule might impact it. It'll also, but the question is, will equity investors have sufficient understanding of, how the capital rule might impact the GSE's business models and therefore the prospective earning streams going forward? So that'll be an important piece. And then, as we were just talking, is the government's ownership sufficiently resolved or understood how it would be resolved for the GSEs to be able to actually produce a restoration plan, and investors to have enough confidence that they understand how an equity investment in these firms would be impacted.
Is there any sense, so that's what would be required to kind of, start to recap. It may be just way too early to know this, but is there any sense of what FHFA would bring to the market in order to recapitalize and then release the GSEs? I mean, do we have any sense of what kind of IPO we're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, the capital rule tells us a fair amount about that, or implies. And so what I'd say, for example, currently both GSEs have a combined of about $30 billion in retained earnings. And they're currently capped through this PSPA letter agreement that I think they signed maybe about a year ago, capped at about $45 billion. So FHFA would need to, amend the part of that amendment to the PSPA, eliminate the sweep, would be part of that. And then they'd have to go out with some combination of retained earnings for some period of time and make a large equity raise, but the magnitude, the orders of magnitude for the total capital requirement is I'm going to say it's probably about $260 billion in total right now, relative to the most recent disclosure that we got from FHFA, and that included in there a more capital required because they won't want to operate right at the minimum capital level, so they'll have to have their own cushion to make sure that they can always meet that. So there's some incremental capital. And so that's, so the incremental piece that they need to raise collectively is about, on the order of, again, about $230 billion. And just as one side, just on the retention side, if you just took their earnings for this last quarter, extrapolated that for a yearly annual earnings of about $18 billion, you're looking at close to 13 years of just going down the retention side, which is why, they have, there's been some discussion about a consent order as a way to potentially move them out of conservatorship before they've been fully capitalized. So that's certainly something that they may or may not be thinking about as kind of a way to accelerate when that IPO could take place, if they wanted, obviously, they want to get them out well before 13 years.
Okay, so we're talking about, I mean, what would be a record IPO by almost any stretch. I mean, to put it in context, the biggest IPO so far in history was just last December when Saudi Aramco raised just over $29 billion. So we're really talking many, many multiples of that. So if we waved the magic wand and assumed that they could raise that capital, is it then just pretty straightforward? You put the GSEs back in the private markets and they continue functioning in the same role that they have today, or not?
Well, I think here's where you know, the market and the impact to primary market, secondary market, policymakers starts to, I think, come to a head a little bit. So, you know, it's possible that, you know, this could be quite disruptive. If there's a material shrinkage of the footprint, who fills that gap? Is it all filled or not? But that's certainly one implication of how this could change. Shrinking the footprint, again, as I kind of alluded to, probably is changing the business model. So, you know, how does that change the earnings streams? That's a little bit unsettling. Another piece of it is, you know, how are MBS investors going to view what the government support is, what government support is there when the GSEs are out of conservatorship? So, for example, you know, right now there's a kind of indefinite backstop because you've got the government during conservatorship, and so there's, if not explicit, there's clearly the explicit part through the PSPAs, but then even implicitly, it suggests, you know, they would be covered. Whereas taking them out of conservatorship, then you've got really a finite, you've got a big finite, about $254 billion worth of backstop. But certainly, actually, some of the responses to the capital, SIFMA and SFA have expressed some concern that, investors, MBS investors might not treat them the same as they currently treat them. And so that could widen spreads and the like and potentially affect liquidity.
Well, I think you probably answered the question I was about to pitch next by indicating a finite one. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to add one other thought here is, it's kind of in this you know, once we start moving in this area that if and as the administration and FHFA, you know, get closer to releasing them from conservatorship, you know, there could end up being significant market pressure for Congress to kind of step in to try to avoid some sort of, or avoid the market disruptions. And if they do, again, under a Republican administration, it's likely that they'll start to take that form, you know, change the reform and move it towards the entrance of new and or multiple tours, as has been discussed in the Treasury white paper on this topic. And this is one that the administration clearly prefers, that outcome, and almost everyone in Congress would prefer it to just simply releasing the GSEs in their current form, I think.
Okay, interesting. So I think that's a very interesting path, at least assuming a Republican win and a continuation of policy. Let's talk a little bit about a Democratic win. So, presumably, the direction shifts away from cap and release. But just to focus a little bit on the short term, Calabria is still there in the chair, and I guess it's not even obvious that a Democratic president could replace him before his term ends. What does he do? I mean, does he finalize capital? Does he amend the PSPA? Are there other things that could happen in that interim period?
Yeah, I think Calabria here, the most likely path would seem to me to be to continue down his current path. So, yeah, I think he finalizes or moves to finalize the capital rule. That's certainly within his complete authority. I think, you know, he potentially keeps moving on the PSPAs. That has to happen. Any work in that side would be easy, obviously, to happen during the lame duck and session and kind of, you know, so there are things that as a Biden administration, if we're a Biden administration to win, it clearly ups the ante during this lame duck period. That doesn't mean that, you know, crazy things happen, but it certainly says that there are certain things that, that he needs to get done potentially if he wants to do it with this Treasury. And so those, you know, would be certainly possible considerations. There's not a lot of time, but they're certainly possible. And kind of depending on how far FHFA maybe goes down this path, you know, a Biden team could signal its intention to stop what they're doing, stop that progress, and when they take over, and thus, you know, create some headwind for the FHFA, and Calabria's course of action here will certainly depend to some degree on how the market accepts it. And so that, too, you know, provides some leverage for a Biden administration to make it clear that the market shouldn't expect these changes to stand. So, you know, one way or another, I think, though, that as you started out or alluded to, I think a Biden administration is most likely to hit the brakes on the recap and release. Certainly, given how important the GSEs are to housing policy, it's just hard to imagine that they would, you know, rubber stamp that current trajectory and simply turn the GSEs over to private hands. I just that seems to be a little too far of a bridge to go.
Okay. Well, what about the possibility of a Biden administration, you know, putting their own director in the chair? I mean, how easy is that to do, since historically FHFA has really had some extraordinary independence?
Yeah, it is, although there have been some relatively recent developments on this. So, I mean, to replace him, it's certainly possible. He's although there are challenges, it's an independent, Calabria is an independent regulator, as you pointed out, and so can only really at this juncture be fired for cause. However, the Supreme Court is set to hear on this issue and rule on this issue and could strike down that limitation, making him an at-will employee, as was done with the CFPB director. So there's some precedent. There are clearly differences in the FHFA HERA statute that make it a perfect analogy, but certainly that's possible. And, you know, that something like that could it's still going to take a bit of time, but it may be clarified or resolved, you know, in the second quarter of 2021, for example.
Okay, got it. So if we end up in a situation where it's either the expiration of Calabria's term or a Democratic administration ends up with their own director in the chair, Fannie and Freddie have been in conservatorship since 2008. How big a priority would it be in a broader Democratic agenda for some kind of resolution of that?
Yeah, it's hard. It's not clear to me, really clear, how much they're going to pivot to certainly the resolution of the GSEs. Although what I'd say is, if housing is part of a Biden administration's economic agenda, I think the odds go up significantly. Otherwise, legislative changes become much less likely and would be a little bit more narrow or targeted in this. But I think that kind of hinges on that. They're clearly going to focus on you know, housing at some level. But the more it's in part of their economic agenda, which is certainly a reasonable to expect those odds go up, that they'll focus also on GSP reform, as that's a key component of how to deliver
Bob, on the Democratic direction for Fannie and Freddie, where do they go? I know there has been a long, long menu of GSE reform proposals that have died in many white papers over the years. If it's not recap and release, where does Biden want to go then with the GSEs, either near term or long term?
So, I think in the near term, one, it would just take time to get their thoughts on it. I'm sure they're doing some of that now, but until in the seats, it takes some time. But in the near term, they'd probably focus mostly on specific policy issues, such as the affordable housing kinds of considerations and so forth. But I think over time, they're likely to redirect the reform efforts to be more about potentially converting them into public utilities. So there's been a lot of discussion about that as kind of a path forward. And that could be, one of a number of forms, but certainly releasing them as releasing from conservatorship as rate of return regulated utilities, much like power companies, but with a very strong housing policy mission focus. Some form of an infrastructure within the government so that it kind of addresses or attempts to address the too big to fail kind of concerns or systemically important concerns.
Okay. Well, we have been going back and forth here, you and I, for, I guess, just over 30 minutes or so. So I want to make sure that I throw the call open to our listeners. As I mentioned at the top of the call, there is a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen, and you can use that to submit questions. So I'd encourage you to do that about any of the topics that we've touched on or topics that we haven't. So please do that. There are some that are coming in. So let me go ahead and grab one of them. So this one, again, is circling back to the issue of equity investment in Fannie or Freddie. And, the client is asking, does anyone wonder why new money would come into the GSEs given the history of how prior investors in equity were treated and how long the courts took to resolve these treatments? How can FHFA guarantee new equity wouldn't be treated as poorly as prior equity holders? Bob, how is that issue bounced around D.C.?
Well, it's certainly understandable. I think it is one of the aspects of an investment in these, quasi-government agencies that I think is hard to control. Most of this, I think, gets done by strong policies by the GSEs and their regulator working in conjunction. There's strong capital rules, clear policies, those types of things, well grounded in the data and the results. But it's certainly a difficult piece, as we've seen through how many things changed and how the rules changed after the 08 crisis. And the implications there, and we've even seen it again here in the pandemic. There are, Congress and lawmakers make some changes, and those are just things that are part and parcel of a investment in a partially private market and a partially government entity. So that's certainly one that will continue to linger. There are just ways to kind of minimize it, I think.
Okay, and somewhat continuing on this line with the idea of making the GSEs reprivatized. So there's a client asking, and you alluded to this earlier, but asking about the cost to consumers for mortgage money. I know on and off there have been estimates of what various amounts of capital would do to that, but any thoughts on whether it's through capital or other influences, any thoughts on what a private version of Fannie and Freddie would do to the cost of mortgage money?
Well, again, here what we did some work on this in our discussion with capital, you know, estimates of maybe 25 to 35 basis points, and part of that higher number is an expectation to pay for a commitment fee associated with the backstop going forward, anticipating that would be required. But the wild card, and that's a large part of that is a function of just the absolute amount of capital. So depending on the capital rule and how that evolves over time, and how the mix of loans that the GSEs do changes, all that will have implications for what happens with guarantee fees and pricing. The more wild card is, given the business model and some of the risks of government and lawmakers changing the rules of the game, if you will, at some level over time, what returns are investors going to look for to make this investment? And a lot of the work and the estimates that have been done to date have kind of assumed an after-tax return in the 9 to 10% range, and if that's materially higher, then obviously the cost of capital goes up, and therefore the guarantee fees would have to go up commensurate to attract those investors. So that's certainly one of the wild cards in kind of what it's going to take for investors to buy this, and therefore what the implications would be to guarantee fees and the cost of mortgage finance.
Okay. So that actually kind of transitions nicely into another question that has popped up on the list, and this is about LLPAs. I guess there was a delay in LLPA increases to December. The question is, do you have any view on what will happen there? Would that be delayed further, or do you think there will be action on that front?
Yeah, I don't think that will be delayed further. I think the director, Calabria, was pretty clear at his most recent testimony, which was after the fact of this announcement, and he made it clear of kind of the incremental costs that go on here. And again, he didn't specifically say, I don't recall, that, the higher capital levels would do that. But my sense is moving to the higher capital levels absolutely will have an impact on that. So this is, they're going to need to move those fees up a bit. So I see, virtually no chance that they pull back on that. I'd be very surprised if they did. I think the biggest uproar was much more about how it was implemented, in that it didn't provide pipeline coverage for many originators in particular, and therefore borrowers. And so that was, I think, the piece and why FHFA subsequently agreed to kind of extend it, the implementation of it out further to cover pipelines.
Okay, thank you. Another question that is, pushing our conversation into a slightly broader area, and this is around mortgage insurers. So I guess the question is, if there is a Democratic sweep with momentum to change the GSEs into public utilities, where do the mortgage insurers play? How do they fit into that scenario?
I don't think that there necessarily has to be a major change to the mortgage insurers. I mean, they are one source of capital to cover losses on the GSEs loans acquired. And so right now there's a statutory requirement for mortgage insurance, or one of three things, but mortgage insurance is the only one really used in the GSE's charters for loans that have loan-to-value ratios above 80. So they would have to unwind that and change that, which may or may not, but that certainly doesn't preclude, even if they did change it, it wouldn't preclude the mortgage insurance companies from being a source of capital and providing insurance on those acquisitions, those higher LTV acquisitions for the GSEs.
So they could presumably, you know, compete to provide guarantees off their own capital base.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Let me swing for a moment here again to a slightly different topic, not unrelated to some of the new capital rules, which, you know, clearly discourage CRT, as you mentioned. So the question from a client is, you know, do you have a view on whether some of the comments on CRT are likely to sway FHFA's final rules? In other words, will it make, is it possible CRT treatment will be a little more favorable?
I think it is. I think it is. I don't anticipate them being dramatic changes. But for example, there's a floor, a 10% floor on exposures for CRT transactions that retained exposures for the GSEs. And so actually this applies to beyond the stress losses all the way up to 100% of the exposure. And so that is the single largest piece of the change that they made that reduced the amount of capital relief that they got for doing those transactions. That one, they could lower that. They could lower that a bit. You know, I don't have a good sense of what they would do, but they could certainly reduce that charge. They could potentially, there's clearly some benefits to equity over CRT. I don't think they're quite as big as the haircut they were giving for equity, or excuse me, for the advantage for equity over CRT. That could be reduced a bit. But again, unless they also, that would make the risk-based components of capital less than is currently there. But if the leverage ratio still stayed at 4%, that would become the binding constraint and still make it still very uneconomic for most of the CRT. Again, unless they significantly reduce the leverage ratio down to something more like 2%, 2.5%, which I think is very unlikely for them to do. They might have some reduction, which would certainly at the margin help some CRT. But if you want to get anywhere near the CRT that's currently being done, which is the vast majority of new acquisition credit losses, you need to be closer to 2 to 2.5%.
You know, on the CRT front, Fannie and Freddie have had very different responses to that. Fannie is effectively suspending its program and Freddie continuing. What do you make of that? You know, why for two organizations that for practical purposes look nearly identical, would you get two very different responses to this capital proposal?
Speculation, one thing I'd say is Freddie has been more reliant at the margin on CRT, more using it a little bit more at the margin than Fannie. I think it's still part of the scorecard. So I think they're saying this is a proposed rule. It's not a final rule, so we're going to keep going ahead. And I'm guessing Fannie is saying, well, that probably doesn't disagree with that necessarily. But look, this has such a big impact, and we have to live with these. If this rule does go into effect, we have to live with these going forward. These transactions that would all of a sudden go from being economic under the current rule to being non-economic under the new rule. We don't need to do any more of those in the interim. Again, I'm speculating a bit here, but it's probably along that line as to why they've come out into slightly different views.
Well, it's very interesting, and I guess if the rules get finalized in December, then, or at least before the end of the year, we will clearly see how the GSEs respond. I just, again, want to remind our listeners that on the right side of your webinar screen, there's a chat feature. You can use that to continue to add questions to our queue. Bob, let me for a moment kind of step away from Fannie and Freddie and talk a little bit about Ginnie Mae, especially since you were at HUD and you know that organization and the role that Ginnie and FHA and VA play so well. Wouldn't that differ across a Republican or Democratic administration? Or is Ginnie Mae, FHA, VA essentially, is there a consensus around that that would leave us without any changes?
Well, I think for... I wouldn't see or expect changes really at Ginnie Mae so much. They're kind of, the agent to securitize and the access to the secondary market on this and so forth. There's nothing that strikes me as demonstrably bigger or leans one way or another, depending on who's running the administration. If there were changes, it's more likely that we'd see them come through the FHA, VA, USDA programs, as those are the insurance and guarantee programs. And so there, if they were going to change pricing through mortgage insurance premiums, or if they were going to change credit policy, that's kind of where they would do that. I think there has been a fair amount of continuity. I mean, there's different focuses and different emphasis on this at each of these groups. But I don't see it as a dramatic shift on the specific insurance programs that they're running.
How about the tension that has always existed, at least at FHA? Between making mortgage money affordable and then keeping FHA insurance, at least the insurance fund, solvent. I'm sure that, since you were sitting in the chair first as chief risk officer, you were in the middle of that debate. Does that swing in a different direction under a Republican or a Democratic administration?
Again, here I think there's slightly maybe a little more bent on the equivalent of capital or making sure the insurance fund is an emphasis, maybe a stronger emphasis there under a Republican administration. Not that or different views about what the adequate level of those insurance premiums should be and the insurance fund's adequacy. And versus also the tension on, like you said, of affordable lending and so forth, and trying to fulfill their statutory mandate. So there's clearly some different views on that. But here I think a large part of this will be driven more by, what's the status of the insurance fund? And we're the end of October, or early November, we should get the latest update. The fund is in a pretty decent state at this point. But if you start to see the insurance fund kind of more in a less than 4 or less than 3% range, you're certainly going to get more calls for higher insurance premiums or potentially tightening of credit terms. And again, it may be just to degrees of how much that changes for a Republican administration versus the Democratic administration. But I think in both cases, the administration there would be, and the FHFA would, or excuse me, the FHA would be concerned about, if it was declining that, below those levels. More normal times, I don't expect there to be a huge number of changes in premiums and in credit terms as we've generally seen.
That will be interesting to see, since largely through forbearance we have seen delinquencies balloon, right, in FHA. So I suppose, depending on how those play out, that could be something interesting to watch. So I'm getting a question here, again, kind of nudging our conversation in, again, some new territory, this one about the private MBS market. It's still, I guess, a shadow of its former self, at least if you're looking to 2008 and before. And so the question is, can private MBS compete against government mortgage programs and bank portfolios? Do you have some thoughts on that?
If you look at, certainly some of the changes that are going on, or proposed changes with capital rule, will level things out or take some advantage away from the GSEs. The GSEs, at least still have a very active TBA market, and so long as that continues to go and there's a good strong sense there, that's a clear advantage over the private market. So in the Venn diagram, where they overlap, there's probably not as much of an opportunity, but there are clearly other non-QM, beyond kind of the underwriting guidelines of the GSEs, those kinds of things, some of these footprint reductions potentially. There's been talk about certain products, whether they're cash out, refinances, second homes, investor properties have been discussed at various periods of time. That shouldn't necessarily or don't necessarily have to be with the GSEs. So there's the debate there, and that could certainly increase the size and the product, if you will, available to the private market. So there's clearly a role here in places where there's not an overlap. It's going to be a little bit more challenging in places where there is an overlap. But also what I think has become really evident in the crisis is, there's still a significant challenge for the private markets on how those markets will function in a stress environment. The pandemic has demonstrated that those markets struggle to maintain ongoing liquidity. The private markets have certainly come back since their spread wides. And are operating more normally now, but it seems to me that it'd be likely for there to continue to be some suffering, some concern from investors about the liquidity of these instruments through a stress event. So I think it's there's still work to be done here and understanding, but that. Or other considerations, because they're demonstrably different between what took place where the government, there was a non-government nexus, and where there wasn't in this pandemic.
Okay, thank you for that. So I think we probably have time at this point for one more question, and this one is coming from a client. I suppose circling back to partly the issue of treating Fannie and Freddie as a utility, although this particular question is centered on UMBS, and it's pretty simple. Why have them both? Why not consolidate all of the functions of the conventional mortgage market under a utility model in one entity?
Yeah, that's certainly an option. It's certainly an option. I think if you tried to merge them, that's a pretty large operational, cultural endeavor, a very complex endeavor. I think that would be difficult. I think while not many degrees of freedom for the diversification in business strategies and so forth, my experience at FHFA and overseeing the conservatorship was a fascinating way of how each of the enterprises chose to confront issues and work through and different suggestions and different approaches to it. And I think that was is beneficial for the marketplace. Some move out ahead in certain areas and others. And so I think there's a slight degree, a degree of greater innovation in that in pushing the envelope. And I think there's also, you know, for the regulator, I think it's also a healthy assistance to be confronted with two different solutions, two very different approaches potentially to a problem, and the regulator have to really force itself to think through which of the approaches is most consistent with their charters, the regulations, the overall law, and as opposed to just simply taking feedback from one individually on that. So I think there are a few things that could do that, but by no means it's not without some merit, and certainly you know, something that I'm sure folks have thought about for sure. I think there's advantages to the two over them, but I could certainly go another way.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks very much for jumping on the line with us today. We appreciate your thoughts and your insight. I'd like to remind everyone that on Wednesday, October 14th at 3 p.m. Eastern, we will have Mark Mazur, Director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, probably the leading tax policy organization, with us for our third and final of our series. This call will be Election 2020, the impact on tax and spending. So please plan on joining us. That concludes today's call, Election 2020, the impact on housing finance. Thank you for dialing in. Be well, and good luck in the markets.